program. Our AMS elections coverage continues as we sit down with presidential candidate Matthew Naylor. And News 101 correspondent Peter Otis has a chance to find out why the North Shore fought so hard to reopen its youth safe house.
To be very little correlation between socioeconomic status and crisis in the home.
We'll have all this plus sports and your 5-day weather forecast coming up this half hour right here on News 101. But first, we have our News 101 reporter Rita Farkas with us interviewing AMS presidential candidate Matthew Naylor.
Hi, Katie. So I'm in studio right now with Matthew Naylor. Welcome to the show. I'd like to begin by just asking you to introduce yourself a little bit about who you are as a student and the position you're running for and why.
Hi there. My name is Matthew Naylor. I'm running for AMS president. My history at UBC has, you know, been a bit of a journey. I started in 2005 as a student in science and, you know, was involved in the Science Undergraduate Society there and eventually got into the biology program and then realized that I didn't want to be in the biology program. And so I moved into doing political science, which I'm in right now. And I've also been the Vice President External Affairs of the AMS for this past year. So why would I want to be president? Well, I think that this society, that the AMS, can do a really huge amount of things for students. And I really love being a part of it. And I think that I have something to contribute. And I'm not done yet, basically. So I'd like to continue.
Okay. What can you sum up your experience as being a VP external and tell us a little bit about how that was for you and how that experience would contribute to you being a presidential candidate?
Absolutely. I've really loved being VP external, and a lot of it has to focus around advocacy and, you know, working for student issues. Some of the big ones that we've been looking at are, there was a bill that went through the House of Commons called Bill C-31, which changed the Canada Elections Act, which would make it a lot more difficult for students to vote because we wouldn't have the proper types of ID. What we were working on is a plan to either get that failed or reach an agreement with the university that would see the students, particularly those living in residence, get some kind of signed statement of address. And I'm really pleased to say that we've actually managed to convince the university to send out signed statement of address to all those Canadian citizens so that they will be able to vote in the ridings if they so choose.
Wow, great. As well, there has been a fair amount of criticism within the election of the AMS, past things they've done and failed at. I know that you yourself have also criticized certain workings of the AMS. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that the biggest failure of the AMS is its inability to be a real transparent and council-driven organization. We have, you know, a council of 55 people or so. It varies from year to year depending on who sends reps and all that. But they aren't used to their full potential. A lot of the AMS is very centralized within the executive, and I think that needs to change because council needs to function as more than just a rubber stamp on executive priorities.
So do you feel that if voted as president, you would be able to sort of contribute to helping out the workings of the AMS?
Absolutely, and that's one of the things in my platform that I'm really proud of. Within 30 days, I want to move to help empower council, to make committee chairs more powerful, to put councillors as opposed to executives at the head of those committees, and allow for more priorities than just the ones that executives ran on to be ones that the AMS is focusing on.
Okay. Also, I've read that you are a proponent of the renovations for the sub-building or a new building. Can you tell me a little bit about why you support the idea of building a new sub and how you envision the new building?
Well, I support building a new sub because this sub currently was built for a campus population of about 20,000 people. We right now have a campus population, I mean a student population alone, of over 4,500 people, 45,000 people. Wow, that's a order of magnitude off. But I'd love to see a place where students can really come together. And some of the renovations that have happened to the sub have been responsive, and I'd like to try and design a new student union building which is going to anticipate some of those changes that are coming along. As president, I'd view my role to be mostly a support role to the vice president administration, because it is their project and it is their building. And as the president, it's not really my place to step in and interfere in all that, but it is my place to help shepherd it along and give them any support they need.
Okay, so what do you say to concerned students who maybe don't see why we need to build a new sub or are concerned about how the construction is going to take place?
Well, one of the commitments that I'd like to make is to try and make this new student union building as sustainable as possible. But the fact of the matter remains that we're a growing society and we need a new student union building. This one, well, great. Is, among other things, filled with asbestos and isn't designed for the types of uses that we need it to fulfill right now. So whether it's now or 10 years down the road, we're going to need to build it, and it's just going to be better to build it now.
Okay, we're going to go break to PSA, and we'll be back to hear more from presidential candidate Matthew Naylor.
CITR. CITR.
Be our guest. Be our guest.
February 8th. Theme soon to be announced. Join us here at CITR in the Student Union Building, the Sub, at UBC for a party garden happening February 8th. Time, theme, soon to be announced. Keep tuning in for more information.
If you're interested in a wicked mix of performances all taking place in one night and locally at one place, then
it's the fourth annual fundraiser for the North Shore Women's Center.
We're talking about an all-women's mixed program, a rare artistic collaboration of acclaimed local performers that have come together for a common cause.
Happening Saturday, February 2nd, 2008 at the Centennial Theatre located at 2300 Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver.
Tickets available after January 24th, either in person or by phone, at the North Shore Women's Center, the Centennial Theatre Box Office, or Little Sisters. Reach us by phone at 604-984-6009.
Performances include dancing, theatre, improv, and more. Early bird tickets available.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're joined in studio once again by AMS presidential candidate Matthew Naylor and News 101 reporter Rita Farkas.
Okay, Matthew, just to continue on with the interview, I'm sure you've been asked this a thousand times and you will continue to be throughout the election, but what's really important for you? What is a few important things on your platform?
Well, you know, mercifully, there's only 72 hours left in the election, so
right.
Thousands, hundreds, we're counting down. But I think the most important thing as part of my platform is talking about provincial lobbying. And, you know, the AMS spends more money on federal lobbying than it does on provincial lobbying, which is a little mixed up to me because post-secondary education is a provincial responsibility. What we should be doing is trying to build an advocacy network, and that's something that I've really been trying to do this past year as Vice President of External Affairs, working together with different student unions to give our voice the added strength of others throughout the student movement. And I think we have a real opportunity to make a real strong impact if we get that up and running as we're trying to do in the next couple of months and continue building it so that it maintains a good advocacy force in the province for years to come.
Why is there so much of an emphasis to advocate for the federal level as opposed to the provincial?
It's not so much an emphasis to advocate at that level, but it's our CASA membership dues. We're a member of the Canadian Alliance of Students Associations, and they cost $46,000 or so per year. We're not a member of any provincial organization and thus don't pay them any fees.
Okay, so we don't necessarily have any direct involvement with the provincial government.
We do, but only in an AMS to the provincial government direct interaction. We actually, as the AMS, have a pretty good reputation over in Victoria.
Okay.
And every year we go over for lobby days, which is something that I've been involved in planning both last year and this year.
Okay, and is there anything else that you are really set on voting for and pushing for this year?
Well, one thing that I'm really looking forward to doing is trying to help bring back Arts County Fair or some form of it. The student government should respond to what students want. You know, governments in general should be doing things that their citizens want. And we want something on the last day of classes. We want an event. Arts County Fair used to be the biggest student-run event in Canada, and now it's been canceled, which is really just a crying shame. So I want to move to forgive the $50,000 that ACF has accumulated over the years. And when you think about it, it's really not that much. After all, Welcome Back Barbecue, which is a smaller scale event, accumulates about $20,000. We budgeted this year for a $20,000 deficit. So, you know, 2.5 years of that, and we've got the same type of debt.
Okay, so do you think this is possible or realistic to forgive that debt?
I think it is. It's all internally done, and I think council would support it. I certainly hope Arts Caucus in particular would support it, but, you know, it's something that council, I think, realizes is really important to the students that they represent. And we have the money in a thing called the Constituency Aid Fund, which is underused as it is. And I think it's a really appropriate use of that money to help fund Arts County Fair.
Okay, great. So no other comments. Good luck with the election. And thanks very much for coming in today. We really appreciate it. I'm sure the listeners have learned a lot.
Thank you very much for having me.
So don't forget, everybody, voting continues online today and tomorrow. What time does voting finish tomorrow? Do you know?
It's at 11:59, and then there's paper balloting on Thursday.
Right. Okay. And the website for that is www.ams.ubc/elections?
ams.ubc.ca/elections.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks again. Katie?
Thanks very much, Rita, and thanks to Matthew for coming out and speaking with us today. And now we're going to take a look at a local story covered by our very own one-time foreign correspondent, Peter Otis, on the struggle to reopen the North Shore's Youth Safe House.
On January 11th, service clubs and organizations around the North Shore celebrated a major victory with the reopening of the North Shore Safe House. To gain an insight into what the Safe House is and why the reopening is so important, I went to the Ambleside Youth Centre in West Vancouver.
I'm Jan Riddell, and I'm with the West Van Youth Outreach. I'm a youth outreach worker.
Why have a safe house?
Well, the idea is to house youth who are out of their home. Either they are experiencing severe conflict in the home, or they're actually homeless, actively homeless, and they need a safe place to stay.
What kind of demand is there for this service on the North Shore?
There seems to be very little correlation between socioeconomic status and crisis in the home. So we still see family conflict, and therefore we still see the average number of teens in crisis, as you would in any community.
The facility's primary objective is to provide safe shelter. They have 5 emergency beds and 2 transition beds, as well as a counselor, doctor, and nurse on staff. Their mission is to deal with trauma and offer access to further community resources before the downward spiral, which eventually leads to the downtown east side.
All the support services that need to kick in when a family has broken down, the Youth Safe House can start that process and put it in place.
If it's even possible, would you be able to give me a profile of like an average user or the type of person that would use this sort of service?
Just off the top of my head, you might have a young woman who's been out of school, out of home off and on. She's been couch surfing. She's hooked up with some very dangerous people and has been using drugs heavily, in and out of prostitution even. So she's living such a high-risk lifestyle that she's in danger, actually, every day. She needs safety first and foremost, and she needs a plan to help her put her life back together again. So in instances like that, school and work, for example, are not priorities. Safety and sanity are priority.
18 months ago, the federal government cut funding to most safe houses around the province, and the North Shore was no exception. Despite the absence of services, the safe house remained a busy place.
Like any service, when you shut it down, it costs more to reopen it. Once you erase the service, to try and reinstate it is more expensive in the long run.
When winter 2006 came, many of the old water pipes broke. In the spring, a family of rats and squirrels took up residence downstairs. Vandals spent their Friday nights breaking windows, and even squatters moved in, finding an unoccupied roof above their head. So, what kind of money was the government saving by cutting this essential North Shore service?
I think the operational budget is approximately $370,000 a year.
So in the great scheme of things, not a lot of money.
Not a lot of money.
And the cost for alternate youth outreach programs was tremendous.
Very challenging, Peter. We were taking kids as young as 14 to places as far away as Richmond and Surrey. Sometimes we'd have a kid downtown in one of the shelters downtown, and they'd be bumped out without our knowing. They'd be put out onto the street with their bags and a bus ticket and told to bus. It was a very unsafe and unmanageable situation, not conducive to helping a youth who's already vulnerable, who's already in crisis.
What followed the shutdown is the sort of grassroots civic movement that makes one proud to be living on the North Shore. Service clubs teamed up with individual donors to reopen the safe house. They spread the word of the government's actions through public awareness campaigns. They wrote angry letters to their MPs and MLAs. They donated furniture and their own labor in a drive to refurbish the house and reopen the center. One West Vancouver family even made a private donation in the amount that it takes to operate the safe house for 1 year. So what followed?
On the heels of that 18-month process, what happened was the provincial government, whether or not they were shamed into doing so, came forward and have now finally committed to some ongoing budget funding.
For now, the future of the facility is safe. That is, until March 2009, when the current wave of funding runs dry. Then, the safe house will be back on the street, fighting for its survival. A future no different from the life of homelessness that the institution is trying to prevent. For News 101, this is Peter Otis.
Do you want to go straight?
If you or any...
Sorry for that technical difficulty, and thanks to Peter Otis for sending us that piece. Now, with a look at other local, provincial, and national news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Leanne Yu and Tracy Fuller.
Lovers of the late-night burger in North Vancouver may soon have limited options. Tonight, the North Vancouver City Council will debate a motion to ban new drive-through windows from being built in restaurants. Councillor Sam Schechter put the motion forward to limit the growth of drive-throughs. Presently, the City of North Vancouver has only one drive-through window, but there are several others in the nearby district of North Vancouver. Schechter says he does not want to close down the existing drive-through, but rather prevent new ones from popping up. Reasons for the ban include the attraction of late-night traffic and noise and the problem of idling cars. The councillor adds transportation accounts for more than a third of greenhouse gas emissions in North Van.
Residents in Prince George may soon be able to breathe a sigh of relief as new efforts are underway to unclog the ice jam along the Nechaco River that has been causing so much flooding. The city has brought in a floating excavator called the Amphibex from Montreal to try to push out some of the large ice chunks from the river. The vessel will work on breaking up the foot of the jam at the juncture between the Fraser and the Nechaco Rivers. City officials say the excavator will likely run for at least 10 days and will operate 24 hours a day. To aid the excavator, a 2.7-kilometer pipeline is being constructed, which will carry hot water from the Canfor Pulp Mill's steam plant. The pipe will dump hot water on the site to aid the breaking up of the ice. Residents have seen little change in the river conditions over the last few days. 20 homes are still on the evacuation order.
British Columbians will be able to continue to use their driver's licenses to cross the U.S. border, even after the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative comes into effect next year. Public Safety Minister Stockwell Day and Premier Gordon Campbell announced today that BC will issue new enhanced driver's licenses. The licenses could serve as an alternative to passports, which will be required of anyone crossing the 49th parallel by land or sea starting in June 2009. Canadian officials had been concerned that passport requirements would curtail trade and tourism. Campbell says the new enhanced licenses will support economic growth on both sides of the border. The provincial government is asking for volunteers to participate in the pilot program, which will issue 500 enhanced driver's licenses that will contain proof of citizenship, proof of citizenship. If the pilot program is effective, the enhanced driver's licenses may become standard in British Columbia.
Caffeine can double the risk of miscarriage. This, according to a new American study, which suggests that pregnant women who drink more than 200 milligrams of caffeine a day had twice the risk of miscarrying as those who consumed no caffeine. 200 milligrams of caffeine is equivalent to 2 cups of regular coffee or 5 cans of caffeinated soda. The increased risk of miscarriage appears to be due to the caffeine itself, rather than the other chemicals found in coffee, because caffeine intake from non-coffee sources, such as caffeinated pop, tea, and hot chocolate, showed a similar increased risk of miscarriage. Past studies have made the link between caffeine and miscarriage, but researchers say theirs is the first to control for other potential risk factors such as age, household income, smoking, and alcohol consumption. The study's lead investigator, D. Kun Lee, says that pregnant women should consider stopping caffeine consumption during pregnancy because this research provides clearer and stronger evidence than ever before that high doses of caffeine intake during pregnancy can increase the risk of miscarriage.
Feeling depressed today? You may support a British psychologist's theory that January 21st will be the most depressing day of 2008. Cliff Arnold began calculating the happiest and gloomiest days of the year in 2005 when he was working as a professor at Cardiff University in Wales. The pseudoscientific formula includes factors such as weather, debt, time passed since Christmas, failed New Year's resolutions, and low motivation. He calls the formula Blue Monday. While Arnold's theory isn't scientifically proven, it does happen to coincide with expected massive economic declines on an international scale. It is also somewhat supported by looking at Health Canada's statistics that approximately 3% of Canadians suffer from seasonal affective disorder, with an additional 15% suffering from a milder version called the winter blues. Health Canada says to combat the effects of the winter blues or Blue Monday, people should make sure to get lots of exercise, especially near light sources.
Thanks for that, Leanne. And we're going to take another break, but stay tuned to CITR with sports coming up with Jeff Sargent. You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR.
We're here to inform you about African Awareness Week happening at UBC between the dates of February 1st and February 8th.
This is a unique event with the purpose of increasing awareness about the importance of Africa studies at UBC. We will accomplish this by holding seminars, workshops, and events during that week and presenting world-class African scholars, writers, artists, and activists to carry our mission of exceeding the layperson's expectations of how much Africa has to give to the world.
All are welcomed. For more information or for details on the seminars, workshops, and events, please visit the website at www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca.
If you want to know the truth and drop a stereotypical perception of Africa, this is your chance to become an informed citizen.
www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:27 and time to find out what's new in UBC Athletics. Here's Jeff Sargent with Thunderbird Eye on Sports.
Thank you very much. Well, there was no bigger game for the UBC Thunderbirds men's basketball team than Friday's tilt in Victoria against the Vikes. With first place in the Canada West Pacific Division on the line and a chance to win the season series with Victoria, the Thunderbirds pulled out a thrilling 79-76 win before a capacity crowd at UVic's McKinnon Gym. Fourth-year guard Chris Dick made his presence felt, returning to action after being sidelined by a strained knee. He led UBC with 25 points and 4 rebounds, while Bryson Cool chipped in 15 points and dominated the boards, picking up a game-high 13 rebounds. Dick says it was a big win, but wants to put things in perspective.
But again, it's a big win, but it's also just regular season yet, too, so we can't get too overhyped about this.
The win puts UBC in sole possession of first place in the Pacific Division with a record of 13-3. That's one game ahead of Victoria at 12-5. But more importantly, UBC also took the season series against the Vikes, meaning they hold the tiebreaker should the teams finish tied in the standings. The Birds are in Langley for a pair of games against Trinity Western this coming Friday and Saturday, and we'll have them both here on CITR beginning just after 8 p.m. It was Kate Haggerty's only game of the season back in her hometown of Victoria, and she made the most of it as the UBC women's basketball team beat the Lady Vikes by a score of 55-45 Friday night. In what was a truly defensive struggle, UBC held Victoria to just 18 points in the second half, en route to their 15th win of the regular season. Haggerty and Erica McGinnis both picked up 14 points, while Leon Evans chipped in 12 and grabbed a game-high 7 rebounds. The 17-1 Simon Fraser clan won both of their games over the weekend, meaning UBC sits two games back of the defending national champs, albeit with a game in hand. UBC visits Trinity Western this coming Friday and Saturday, and you can catch all the action right here on CITR. Tip-off is at 6 p.m. both nights. The UBC men's hockey team can breathe a sigh of relief for now, having finally ended their free fall that marked the first two weekends of conference play here in 2008. The Thunderbirds have vaulted back into the hunt for a home playoff berth after sweeping their final weekend series with the last-place Lethbridge Pronghorns. After a tight physical 2-1 win on Friday, UBC returned to action at the Winter Sports Center Saturday and picked up a gutsy 7-5 victory despite being outshot 41-30. Jovan Matic scored twice in the first period Saturday to put the Birds up 4-0, urging Lethbridge coach Greg Gatto to replace John Haggis with Scott Bowles after 27 minutes between the pipes. Lethbridge narrowed the deficit to 5-4 before Curtis Bilston notched a pair in the third to put the game out of reach. UBC is now back at 500 with a record of 11-11 and fourth place in the Canada West. However, they sit only 3 points up on their next opponent, that's Manitoba, with two more games played than the Bisons. The Birds will need at least a split in Winnipeg next weekend in order to have a realistic shot at finishing fourth in the Canada West and hosting their first playoff series in 37 years. On the women's side of UBC hockey, time is running out to make a push for the postseason after back-to-back losses to the Regina Cougars this past weekend. After getting lit up 6-0 on Friday, the Cougars came back with a 7-3 win over the Thunderbirds on Saturday. Now it's do or die for UBC next weekend in Saskatoon if they hope to make the Canada West playoffs. UBC sits 6 points back of Saskatchewan for the fourth and final playoff spot in the conference, so the 4-point games next weekend represent the best opportunity to make up ground on the Huskies. Still, the Birds will need help from Regina the weekend after when they face Saskatchewan, while UBC attempts at least one more upset of the Alberta Pandas in the final weekend of regular season play. Those games will be played February 1st and 2nd at the UBC Winter Sports Center. The men's volleyball team suffered their first loss in 11 games Saturday as the Thompson Rivers Wolfpack upset the Thunderbirds in 5 sets at War Memorial Gym. On Friday, UBC pulled out the 5-set win after a scare by the same Kamloops visitors. Saturday's rematch, though, had UBC out to a comfortable 2-set lead, and they had the Wolfpack on their heels with a game point situation, but Thompson Rivers battled back to take the third set 27-25, keeping their hopes alive. The third set win signaled a momentum shift for Thompson Rivers as they took the fourth set 25-17, forcing the final frame. The Wolfpack then cruised to a 15-10 fifth set victory, splitting the weekend series. Now, despite the loss, UBC still sits tied with Alberta for first place in the Canada West, although the Bears have 2 games in hand. Next up for UBC is a crucial 2-game series this weekend against those Golden Bears at War Memorial Gym. First serve for both Friday and Saturday's matches are set for 7 p.m., and both will be webcast live at citr.ca. Well, the women's volleyball team is now working on a 10-game winning streak. That's thanks to their weekend sweep of the Lady Wolfpack. The Thunderbirds took 4 sets both nights to defeat Thompson Rivers, as Jen Hinze led the way with 16 kills in Saturday's rematch, while Liz Cordonnier added 10 kills of her own. Marissa Field also had a strong night with 9 kills and an impressive .667 hitting percentage. The pair of wins improves UBC's record to 13-1 as they sit tied for first place in the Canada West with the Manitoba Bisons. The Ladybirds will now travel to Edmonton to take on the Alberta Pandas for a 2-game series this weekend. Now you're up to date with all of your Thunderbirds athletics. I'm Jeff Sargent.
Thanks, Jeff, for keeping us up to date. And we wrap up tonight with our meteorologist, Selena Ferris, and your 5-day weather forecast. Selena?
More of this cold, sunny weather is headed our way. The current ridge of high pressure over the region is drawing cold air in from the north. So expect clear conditions, much like today, to persist all week long, with highs around 2 degrees and lows down to negative 5. So don't forget that extra sweater if you plan to spend some time outside enjoying the winter sunshine. By the weekend, the clouds will be rolling back in again, with the possibility of flurries. That's your five-day weather, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
And that's our program for Monday, January 21st, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, this is Katie Comley thanking you for listening. Stay tuned for Wings coming up next on 101.9 FM CITR.